Ballard's Mill. Sunday, January 10. I lean against the edge of a work table down at the mill, watching my husband eat breakfast. Ephraim sits beside the wood stove, tin plate on his lap, and takes large but precise mouthfuls of scrambled egg and fried potato. The bacon is long gone. He ate that first. "Thank you," he says. "I was about to start gnawing on my ankle." "Not much meat there. Next time, consider your arse." "Can't reach it," he says, bending to the side and chomping the air with his teeth. I laugh. It is good to be married to a man with a gift for levity. "I am glad you haven't dried up and gone to seed," I tell him. "So many men your age do." "Not many of them have a wife that looks like you. I have incentive." I slide off the table and cross the old weathered floorboards, then take the plate from his hands and set it on the stove before straddling his lap and wrapping my arms around his neck. "There is no need to lie, husband. We both know that I am not pretty. I never have been." He says nothing for a moment, just studies me as though seeing my face for the first time. Then he makes one of those indistinguishable male noises, half grunt, half sigh. He runs a finger down the bridge of my nose, over my lips, up one cheekbone, and down my chin. He brushes a few loose strands of hair away from my eyes and says, "When you were young, your eyes were dark, chestnut like your hair. And do you know what the bard says about chestnut eyes?" "Nothing, I'm sure." "An excellent color. Your chestnut was ever the only color." "I do believe you just made that up." "In fact, I did not. It's from As You Like It. But that's not the point I'm trying to make. Your eyes used to be dark, but now they have lightened, golden like acorns." I snort. "And I suppose the bard would have something to say about acorns as well. No doubt from The Taming of the Shrew." "He had much to say about acorns. He was a man well acquainted with nature, was Shakespeare. But my favorite line is also from As You Like It, though unlike Celia, I did not find you under a tree dropped like an acorn. It was a field the first time I saw you, and from what I remember, there wasn't an oak in sight. But my point is that something about you had to mellow with age, given that your temperament wouldn't budge an inch. It was left to your eyes to soften, and they are lovelier now than ever. So no, Mrs. Ballard, you might not be pretty, but I'll be damned if you are not the most beautiful woman I have ever seen." "You are biased. I am proud." It has been a few years since we made love in the mill, but given his honeyed words, I think this might be a good time to resurrect the habit. I scoot closer, hips rising, just as we hear a sound at the door. A man almost laughs, but saves himself at the last second by clearing his throat, followed by an ahem. Barnabas Lambert, shaved and dressed in his Sunday best, leans against the doorframe, with the kind of precocious grin best suited to a 12-year-old boy.
"Sorry to interrupt," he says. "That makes two of us," Ephraim mutters, as he gently lifts me from his lap so that he can stand.
"That is Barnabas Lambert," I remind him. Ephraim squints.
"You are the officer of the court from Vassalboro."
"Yes."
I am pleased to see him and not afraid to show it, so I grace him with a smile. Ephraim notes this act of rare approval, takes the man in curiously.
"My wife says you're the one who told Obadiah Wood that Burgess was murdered."
Barnabas looks at me with an expression that falls somewhere between intrigue and annoyance.
"I am, though she could have warned me up front that the man was dead. Came as a shock, as she intended, I'm sure."
"Is that why you're here?" I ask.
"There are two reasons, actually, and that's one of them."
He crosses the floor and extends his hand to Ephraim,
introducing himself formally. Barnabas Lambert. I am pleased to officially meet you, sir.
Oh.
I look him over again. There's a fresh shaving nick on his jaw, and his shirt collar has been pressed. The look that passes between Ephraim and me is so quick Barnabas shouldn't catch it, but he does. Then his eyes narrow as his own gaze shifts between us. Clever boy.
Why would a dead man bring you back to Hollowell?
Ephraim asks.
Because an inquiry has been opened into his cause of death. Judge Wood has questions regarding the circumstances and the manner of his demise, and has instructed the sessions to take up the matter on the 29th when they convene here in the Hook.
He turns back to me.
I thought you might want to know that there is growing interest among the other two judges about the accusation made against Mr. Foster.
The kind of questions that would behoove him to secure a lawyer?
Perhaps.
Thank you for the warning.
Now that the two of you have made amends, Ephraim's voice is dry as toast. He looks young Barnabas over with renewed interest. You must have ridden half the night to arrive so early. I came in yesterday, stayed at the tavern.
His next words are chosen carefully, and he isn't afraid to meet Ephraim's eyes when he says them.
I didn't want to arrive smelling like the road. And why is that?
They stand a foot apart, eyes locked on each other. Ephraim has him beat in height, but I think the boy might be a near match in terms of nerve. Without looking away, he takes off his hat and holds it in front of him. He grins big and wide, not the least embarrassed.
That would bring me to the second reason. I thought I might say hello to your daughter.
Ephraim has guessed this purpose, of course. I did tell him about Barnabas's first visit and the interest Dolly took in him. But no man is ever really prepared when a boy comes knocking, and Ephraim, good father though he is, cannot keep the growl out of his voice when he answers,
"Hello? That's all you want to say?"
I've heard it's a good place to start on a first meeting.
There's a bit of triumph in Ephraim's eyes.
First meeting? And do you even know her name, given that you've never spoken to her?
Dolly. Short for Dorothy, or so I've been told. A family name, I'd guess.
He looks to me in question. After my mother, I tell him.
She is too young for courting,
Ephraim says. In fact, Dolly will be 18 next month. A mere 2 months younger than I was when Ephraim first came to court me. He knows I'm thinking this, of course, so he stubbornly refuses to meet my gaze. Again, Barnabas flashes that impish smile, a hint of confidence without hubris. If I am not careful, I will end up being quite fond of this boy. It is a rare man who can handle my husband.
Well, I'm young too, which is good. But I never said a word about courting. I only said I'd like to say hello. And yet you've still not explained why.
He shrugs.
I like the way she looks. At me, I mean. Twice I caught her eye, and she didn't blush or giggle. There doesn't seem to be a silly thing about your daughter, from what little I have seen. She reminds me of Mistress Ballard. Clever, both of them. Same as my own mother.
It's a good speech, but Ephraim won't give in quickly. He lets Barnabas stand there a moment, long enough for a twinge of uncertainty to creep into the boy's muddy eyes, before he finally lifts his hand and holds it out.
Ephraim Ballard.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, I say, wiping my hands on my apron, would you like some breakfast? I believe Dolly is cleaning up the last of it now.
I would like that very much.
I wait until Ephraim and Barnabas have gone up the path toward the house, and then I pull the mill door closed. Outside, in his mews, Percy squawks his displeasure at our departure, but I pay him no mind. He's had his breakfast already, and soon Ephraim will let him out to fly. I follow the men up the path,
watching as they make their way between the snowbanks, noting how they walk. Ephraim like a bull, sure and strong, and Barnabas like a stag, young and ready. There is much, I think, that you can tell about a man by the way he walks. Nothing timid on the path before me, though, so I catch up and try to prepare myself for what will come next. Dolly is waiting at the door. She leans against the frame just as she did the last time Barnabas Lampard came through the garden gate, one hand on her hip and her face flushed with curiosity. She must have seen him ride up, must have been hoping that we would come back to the house. I poke Ephraim in the ribs and whisper, "Understand my father a bit better now, perhaps?" He answers with an irritated grunt. Dolly's cheeks are bright, and her hair is brushed, falling down her back in rivers of loose brown curls. But the prettiest thing about her are those eyes, same as her father's. It may as well be midsummer for all the blue beneath her heavy lashes. And when she smiles at Barnabas, I can hear Ephraim's teeth grind together. I tug at his hand and pull him back a half step. "Remember, love," I laugh. "It's a woman who does the choosing. You said so yourself." "And I'm a fool for ever mentioning it to you." Dolly lets Barnabas into the house, and we follow, neither of us quite ready to see our youngest daughter so easily felled by Cupid's arrow. Dr. Coleman's Store. Tuesday, January 12. "Aren't you coming in?" I ask. Ephraim shakes his head.
"Not today. I need to go across the river and inquire about a lumber order."
There are only two ways to cross the Kennebec, by ferry in warmer months or by foot once it's frozen. It is nearly half a mile wide at points and deep enough that no one has ever touched the bottom. The current likely has something to do with that, however. The Kennebec is not the kind of river that you swim. Everything on the west side is considered Hollowell, and everything on the east, Fort Western, even though they are, in practicality, one village, split in half, spanning 2 miles in length. But each side has its homes and shops, its own community. Though it is treacherous, I almost prefer crossing the river on foot. The ferry takes too long. "Be safe," I tell him.
"Not to worry. The ice is thick enough. And I'll only be gone an hour. Meet me at the tavern for a pint when you're done here."
Ephraim kisses my forehead, then steps off the boardwalk toward the well-trod path that leads down the bank and across the frozen river. I watch him begin the crossing, sure-footed as always. Then I turn back to the store. Coleman is doing steady business today, so I wait for a group of loggers to finish buying their tools before I approach the counter.
"What might you be needing today, Mistress Ballard?"
he asks. "Nothing, unless you've come across something new to read." I hoist my basket onto the counter and pull back my cloak. My copy of Emmeline sits on top of 2 dozen neatly stacked candles. Their bottoms have been cut flat and their wicks trimmed.
"You've brought a new batch, I see."
Coleman reaches out his right hand and plucks a candle from the basket. He sniffs the dried wax, then picks at a fleck of lavender with his thumbnail.
"These are fancy."
"Just because something is useful doesn't mean it can't be pretty." Most families in the Hook make their own candles, but there is always a traveler or housewife or shopkeeper who finds themselves in a pinch, and Coleman's is the first place they turn. He likes meeting the need, and I like the chance to barter. I come here at least twice a month in the hopes that he has gotten a new shipment of coffee, sugar, and chocolate from Boston, though the odds of those items having arrived since the river closed are slim. Most important, however, I'm hoping to find something new to read. Having finished Emmeline, I'm eager for another story. Soon he turns his attention from the candles to the book.
"Any good?"
Coleman asks, screwing up his eye to focus on the title. "I liked it better than most, and the author is English.
You'll approve of that," I say with a wink.
It's about a woman on the fringes of high society who refuses the traditional roles assigned to her, finding her own way, a love of her own choosing, and therefore ends up both wealthy and happy in the end.
So it is a fantasy, then?
Absolutely not. It is a possibility. Although I must say it felt rather, what's the right word? Gothic, perhaps, filled with wild remote locations and mysterious happenings. I think you would enjoy it.
Then I will trade ye book for book, Mistress Ballard, he says, reaching under the counter and pulling out a novel that is rather worse for wear and missing half the cover. Although, to be honest, my damned eye is fading on me, and it won't be long afore I canna read at all. I'll have to hire a shop boy to keep the ledgers.
I take his book and turn to the title page. The Castles of Athlin and Dunbane by Anne Radcliffe, I say. You have read it.
What was the word ye just used? Gothic? If that's what ye are looking for, you will be satisfied. It's a full-blown medieval Scottish feud.
Then it will suit my mood perfectly. I tuck the book under my arm and begin unpacking the candles.
Anything else while you're here?
I'd love some coffee and sugar, but would settle for cornmeal and molasses.
None of the former, I'm afraid, not until the river opens. But I can give you a bag of cornmeal and a pint of molasses. More'n enough on your account to cover it.
How?
Mr. Sewell came in, added money to your account, and bought a pound of chocolate and half a pound of tea for you as well. They're wrapped and set aside for you.
Sometimes I am paid in coin before leaving a patient's house, sometimes with food or livestock or bartering later in the year. But just as often, a grateful husband will add to my account at Coleman's or surprise me with a purchase left waiting for my arrival.
Oh, I say, that was good of him.
To hear him talk, 'twas the other way around. He said his wife nearly died because of that laudanum, and that you saved her.
I don't know what to say to this, so I don't say anything at all.
I know you think that half the town is turned against you, Martha, what with all the trouble you've had. But there are just as many who'll not hear an ill word against you. Mr. Sewell counts himself in that number. And so do I.
Cyrus is at Pollard's Tavern when I arrive, and he waves me over to his table.
What are you doing here? I ask.
He slides a ledger across the table, taps the line that shows a lumber order has been delivered and paid for.
Chandler Robbins, I read the name. I take it he has another ship under construction?
Cyrus nods. Shows the order details for 70 boards of white oak and 2 pine logs for the mast. His wife is expecting their first child soon, I tell him.
As though it matters, as though he cares.
Although perhaps that isn't fair. Cyrus is far more interested in having a family than Jonathan, which is the real tragedy of his circumstance. He is a good, strong, kind, intelligent man. But the simple fact of this world is that women look at him as though he's stupid, simply because he cannot speak. They fear it is an illness, that it's catching, some affliction that could be passed on to their children. So the girls of this town have always looked right through him, and he has built a wall around his heart in response.
Every woman wants a man to whisper soft words in the darkness,
Ephraim told me once. When I was lamenting Cyrus's lack of prospects. There was no malice in the statement, only heartbreak. And I have never forgotten it because it is true.
Did you know that Chandler Robbins was one of the men who cut Joshua Burgess from the ice? I ask.
If Cyrus heard me, he doesn't bother to acknowledge the question. His eyes are latched onto someone behind me, and he follows them through the room. He sits a little straighter, eyes curious, when a set of footsteps comes to a stop behind me. When I turn, Sarah White is standing there with a coin purse in her hand and a smile on her face.
Hello, Martha, she says.
Cyrus. My son gives her a broad, pleased grin in response, and I think that his cheeks have turned a bit pink.
May I? Sarah asks, indicating the bench.
Of course. I scoot aside to make room.
She sits, arranges her skirt, then holds out a small cloth purse.
Here. What is this?
6 shillings for your fee, and another 12 for the court's fine. Exactly what I owe you.
My da said he'd not pay a cent of it, that it was my responsibility, so I've been doing odd jobs around town for those who'd have me. I earned every bit of it myself.
The fining of unwed mothers is a cruel system, meant to humiliate women, and therefore dissuade them from carnal activity. But given that women do not conceive children on their own, and there is no law that fines men for their participation, it is the worst kind of hypocrisy as well. The minimum and maximum fines are set by law, but the amounts in between are up to the whim of each individual judge and can range from inconvenient on one end to crippling on the other. The law, grossly titled An Act for the Punishment of Fornication and for the Maintenance of Bastard Children, states that any woman who commits fornication shall be fined no less than 6 shillings for the first offense and no more than £3. Every offense after that ranges between 12 shillings and £6. If a woman is unable to pay the fine, she is committed to the jail yard for a minimum of 48 hours, but the court can extend it to 30 days. Joseph North decides the cases in this county and is not typically known for his leniency. But for Sarah, he'd handed down the minimum fine, no doubt because I had offered to pay it myself that day, as Sarah had not a shilling to her name. It has taken her 6 months to earn the money.
Sarah, I insist. It's my debt, and I want to pay it.
She drops the purse into my hand and closes my fingers around it. There is something in her eyes, a kind of light, that I cannot argue with. Sarah is proud of herself for accomplishing this, and I'll not take that from her. Cyrus senses it too, is leaning across the table on his forearms. I know that he wants to tell her something, that the words would come tumbling out if only he had the ability. Instead, he holds up one finger, then opens the ledger and rips out a page from the back. He grabs ink and quill from his case, and we both watch as he scribbles a short note, then slides it across the table. You are a good woman, Sarah White. She takes the paper and smiles at it with a frustrated expression.
I'm sorry, Cyrus. I cannot read.
His gaze drops from hers, falls to the table. He nods once, resigned, embarrassed. He says you're a good woman. And this makes her laugh. He might be the only one in the hook who does. Not the only one, I say. Not by a long shot. And that's when the idea occurs to me.
What are you doing on Saturday?
Nothing, as far as I know.
You should come to the frolic. It's at the mill this time. We would love to have you.
I look to Cyrus for confirmation, and he offers an eager nod.
I don't know. It's just one evening.
What about the baby?
Bring her.
There won't be any shortage of arms willing to rock her while you dance. I can see her hesitate, look to the door for a way out. Think about it, please. Sarah gives me a half-hearted nod.
I will.
Promise? She smiles again, but sadly this time.
For you, Martha, yes.
She says goodbye, but my gaze is on Cyrus as she leaves. He tracks her across the room and doesn't meet my eyes until she's out the door.
Oh, how have I missed this?
How long, I ask. He flips his hands up as though asking,
what?
How long have you been in love with her? Cyrus clenches his jaw, shudders. Then he grabs the note, wads it in his fist, and walks to the great crackling hearth. He throws his missive into the flames and leaves Pollard's without another glance in my direction. I blow out a long breath between pursed lips. That long, I suppose. The air outside the tavern is clear, but the breeze coming off the river is cold enough to burn. I untie Brutus from the hitching post and lead him the short distance to where Sterling drinks from a trough. The ice has been broken, but sharp little chunks float on the surface. "You'll freeze your lips off," I tell the horse, scratching his great barreled chest beneath the leather saddle strap.
"It's a wonder he doesn't bite you."
Ephraim lays a calming hand on my shoulder, knowing I will jump at his voice. "How do you do that? In all the years we have been married, I have yet to hear the man sneak up behind me." He shrugs, taking Brutus's reins from my hands and inspecting the saddle and harness, as though they're in danger of immediate failure. It isn't that he doesn't trust my ability with a horse, but rather he isn't willing to let me on one unless he's judged it fit to ride. Certainly not one as willful as Brutus. "You're late. You said you'd be an hour. It's been two."
"I picked up 3 more lumber orders at the fort. Then I had a bit of a chat with James Wall."
I lift an eyebrow.
"Did you know he's building a distillery?"
"I'd heard."
"He's leased a stretch of land along Farwell Brook. It's not big enough to use for mill trading, but it's cold and spring-fed, and just right if you're the kind of man intent on making whiskey. He pays the lease with what he earns from us."
"Us?"
"What Jonathan and Cyrus and I pay him to help us get the boards downriver."
"Ah, that explains a lot." It's Ephraim's turn to give me the questioning glance. "They never made their last delivery, did they? Got stuck in the river instead. And James had nothing with which to pay when the note came due."
"That's not entirely true," Ephraim says,
then studies my face.
"He was only $10 short. But that's because North required payment in full for the entire loan."
"What's James going to do about it?"
"I offered to cover the difference. Part of me feels responsible, but he refused. Says he won't go into debt again. He plans on selling his horse to pay the note."
"The Pacer?"
"Aye. Says he can cover what he owes North, then buy a nag to replace it."
I've never understood James's obsession with that particular breed, but I'm sad to think of him losing the horse, and all because he went to the wrong man for a loan.
"Anyway," Ephraim shrugs, "that's what took me so long."
"Well, you missed something interesting as a result."
"And what would that be?"
I pull the coin purse out of my pocket and hand it to him.
"What's this?"
"My fee for delivering Sarah White, and the court fine, 18 shillings, paid in full. She brought it to me herself."
"That must have taken her months."
"It isn't fair, Ephraim. There has to be a better way."
"And?"
"And what?" He laughs.
"I know you well enough to know when there's an and."
Ephraim sets a hand on either side of my waist and helps me into the saddle. Then he swings a leg over Sterling's back and settles into his own. We turn for home just as the sky begins to darken. "I do have an idea," I say, trying to sort out my thoughts so they'll make sense.
"Or two." "I'm listening."
"Sarah can't afford another turn before the court. It will be jail time if she has another child out of wedlock."
"Are you saying she's not going to change her ways?"
"I am saying that the father of her child gladly took advantage of her body, but left town long before the results of his lust brought her before the court. There is no justice in that."
"Sarah brought him to bed willingly enough. Or at least she's never said different. She's hardly innocent in the matter."
"Innocent? No. But she also has no legal recourse. The man is gone and she cannot collect maintenance for her child."
"Her parents haven't turned her out."
"But they aren't supporting her either. She needs a real way to make a living, not odd jobs that pay a shilling here and there."
"So what do you intend to do for her?"
exactly what you did for me. It takes him a moment to figure out what I mean.
You'll teach her to read?
If she's to have any real chance in this world, that's where she has to start. After a quarter mile, we turn aside from the wide Kennebec, where Mill Brook meets the river. Farther on, Water Street narrows and becomes little more than a glorified cattle trail that passes through Vassalboro and follows the Kennebec up its banks, eventually disappearing 150 miles north, as does the river itself, into its source, Moosehead Lake.
And this second idea of yours?
If she can't find a job, then perhaps I can help her find a husband.
I suppose you have a man in mind?
I do.
And you think it ought to be Jonathan?
I open my mouth, stunned, ready to argue, but Ephraim mistakes my meaning and interrupts.
I know it bothers you that he's taken no interest in courtship.
He's 26. He ought to be courting someone.
That's the standard you have for him, just someone, and Sarah would be your choice?
Sarah would be a great catch for any man, Jonathan or otherwise. But no, I hadn't thought of pairing them together.
Who then?
Cyrus.
This does surprise him. And what made you think of that?
You'd have thought the same if you saw the way he looked at her just now. I suspect he's been carrying a torch for that girl for some time. I tell him about the note, how he threw it in the fire and stormed off.
Ephraim rides in silence for a while. He won't appreciate you meddling, Martha.
I'm not going to meddle,
he snorts.
I am simply going to create an opportunity.
For whom? Yourself?
For Cyrus.
He can't speak and Sarah can't read.
I smile at my husband. Yet. Darwin's Wharf, Monday, January 18. Sam Darwin is not happy to see me. I can tell by the set of his mouth and the way he rounds his shoulders as he throws a bale of hay over the fence. A giant red and white bull with long hooked horns begins to tear at it. Then he's muzzle deep, gorging himself. Within seconds, the hay is scattered, and Sam is stomping through the snow toward me.
I know what you're here to ask, he says, and it's none of your business.
The man has never been rude before, not in all the years I have known him, and this, more than anything, stuns me into silence. He can see his misstep, though, and has the good grace to stop. I haven't come to ask you anything.
You haven't?
No, I've come to congratulate you on your marriage. And to bring a wedding gift. Though I am a month late, and I do apologize for that. Abashed, color floods his cheeks.
I'm sorry. I assumed...
What?
I thought you came to ask why May went to see doctor.
That's no more my business than it is yours to know why I was there.
I'm truly sorry. That was very rude of me.
Sam looks at the ground.
You have been kind to us, and I had no right to assume anything.
You are right to be protective of your bride, no matter the supposed offense. Sam darts a quick glance at my face, then returns the steady gaze to his feet.
I've already heard the rumors. They're spreading fast, you know.
Rumors do that, and you did go to housekeeping quickly. I can see Sam stiffen again. Can see the defensiveness creep in around the corners of his mouth. I brought a quilt for May. I make an extra one every winter. It's a risk, but I take a step forward and set my hand on his arm. No woman should go to housekeeping without a proper quilt. I don't add that rushed marriages are nothing new in Hollowell, nor are the assumptions that go along with them. Tied to my saddlebag is the large wrapped parcel. I undo the binding and hand it to Sam. He lifts it from my arms carefully, as though picking up a child. Your marriage is your own business, Sam. Don't let anyone tell you different.
Thank you. May's mother wouldn't make her a quilt. She's too angry. Will probably never forgive me.
Of course she will.
You don't know her mother.
I do, as a matter of fact. But regardless, my own mother forgave me and Ephraim as well after we went to housekeeping early. He looks up at me.
You didn't wait?
No, I say. Ephraim took me home that evening. A different sort of young man might blush at those words. He might stammer or shift his feet. But Sam Dalwyn is staid and steady, practical, and he makes no show of being ashamed at the desire to bed his own wife.
I'm glad you understand, he says. Not many do.
You would be astonished at the things I understand, Sam. I can see the decision running through his eyes. First the question, then the answer, one chasing the other. Finally, he asks,
do you want to come in? I am certain May would like to see you.
I would like that very much, I tell him, then go back to my saddlebag. Brutus is tied up at the post, drinking from a trough and grazing on the bale of hay beside it. I lift a bottle from my bag. And I have another gift, but this one is just for May. The house is small but neat, designed well so that Sam can add on as their family grows. It is set back from Water Street by a good 50 yards, but it has views of their wharf and the river beyond. Sam Dalwyn was fortunate to lease one of the last lots with river frontage, and is therefore able to take advantage of both the mill traffic and his 80 acres of farmland. If he manages it well, he'll provide a solid living for his young family. The front room is warm, clean, and smells of new wood and freshly baked bread. May sits in a rocking chair beside the hearth, a pile of knitting in her lap and a cup of tea on the small table to her left. At first, she looks startled to see me, but then she smiles, and two perfect round dimples appear at the corners of her pretty mouth. Mistress Ballard, she says, please come in. Sam holds up the parcel.
Martha has brought us a wedding gift.
How kind of you, our very first, May says, trying to stand. But she isn't even fully upright when she plops back into her chair again, dizzy. That's when I notice the bucket at her feet, and within seconds, May has grabbed it and leaned over, retching. I'm so sorry, she gags,
retches again.
Forgive me, I...
Her words are lost in the gurgling, wet slop.
I am at her side immediately, kneeling, pushing the hair away from May's clammy forehead. A palm set against her forehead proves that she has no fever, so I put the bottle I've brought on the little table and, operating on instinct, begin to give orders. Sam, go get a cold, wet cloth. He's back in less than 30 seconds, and I press the fabric to May's forehead. Lean back, rest your head on the chair, breathe through your nose. The girl obeys without question as I pat her brow and cheeks with the cool cloth. Are you ill? I ask, in a manner of speaking. One look at Sam proves my suspicions correct. He closes his eyes slowly, sighs, nods. May is pregnant. This angers me. Not because the child was clearly conceived out of wedlock, that happens more often than not in Hollowell, but because it gives the gossipers room to gloat. I had hoped to suffocate that rumor. How far along, I ask. I have missed 2 cycles, and they've only been married 1 month. Tears trickle down her cheeks, and I wipe them away. Then, when I'm sure the girl won't flinch, I cup May's face in my hands. No baby is conceived apart from the will of God, May. If you are pregnant, it means that you have been touched by providence, and you will never hear me say an ill word about the child you carry, nor will I let anyone do so in my presence. Do you understand? May nods, continues crying. I cannot tell if she is afraid or ashamed or simply ill. The act of mothering is not limited to the bearing of children. This is another thing that I have learned in all my long years of midwifery. Labor may render every woman a novice, but pregnancy renders every woman a child, scared, vulnerable, ill, exhausted, frail, A pregnant woman is, in most ways, a helpless woman. Her emotions are erratic. Her body betrays her. Since Mae Dawen is presently without a mother of her own, I stroke her hair, encourage her to breathe, promise that her stomach will settle. And it does. The wave subsides, and then we are left in the vulnerable aftermath of confession. I do not make eye contact with Mae. I do not look at Sam. Instead, I settle my gaze on the crackling fire, and I offer them something that I rarely part with, the secrets of our neighbors. Every year, I deliver children born out of wedlock in this town. You know those names. Most everyone in Hollowell does. They come to court just to hear me say them. Last year, there were 2. The year before, 5. What you do not know is how many of the children I deliver are conceived out of wedlock. 4 in 10. An early birth, they call it. Premature. And not a one of them underweight. Our Puritan fathers would have us believe that lovemaking rarely happens outside the marriage bed. But I know better than most that it rarely happens, for the first time at least, within that bed. I am astonished to find that Sam is also crying now. He looks as though he wants to pluck Mae right out of my arms and run away with her. Words can be a gift, but so can silence. And that is the next thing I give to this new family. I rest my cheek against May's soft brown hair and let the silence settle around us like autumn leaves. I do not stand again until the need for it has dissipated. I brought you something, I tell May. I pick up the bottle, hand it to her. It is a syrup of bearberry leaf, cranberry, green tea, and mint. It helps calm infections of the urinary tract. These are common in newlywed women, a result of overexertion. I had wondered what it would take to make Sam Dawen blush, and now I know. His cheeks are flaming. 1 spoonful morning and night, taken with a glass of water. May runs a fingernail over the cork. Thank you. Now, open your other gift. Sam hands the parcel to May, and she tears off the paper. The quilt is large, big enough to cover them both, and is made of scraps of fabric that I have gathered and kept over the years for this purpose. Every year I make an extra quilt, sewn in bits and pieces at night, before the fire, when my other work is done. And every year I choose this same pattern. It is called wedding rings, soft loops intertwined and set against a pale background with a solid border. I do this because every year there is a wedding, sometimes rushed, sometimes performed according to the standards of our town. Yet each young bride finds herself in a new home and does not know how to make it her home. This, a simple piece of bedding, is the answer. Everyone must sleep, and to do so beneath a warm quilt, tenderly made, is the first thing that helps a house become a home. Again, there are tears, but happy ones this time. I don't know how to thank you. May presses the heels of her hands into her eyes. You don't have to. I don't want to overwhelm the young couple any more than I already have. So I say my farewell, then add, May is lucky to have you, Sam. Do not be overly hard on yourself. He and May exchange a look that I cannot decipher, and the reciprocated smile dies on his lips. Ballard's Mill, Saturday, January 23. Barnabas Lambert plays the fiddle. I cannot explain why this astonishes me, but it does. He'd seemed a more serious type, I suppose. One does not typically equate a law enforcement officer with being a musician. But those same hands that sent James Wall sprawling to the ground are every bit as nimble with bow and string. He stands on a large stump in the corner of the mill, sawing his way through a lively rendition of Soldier's Joy. I've always liked this song, Ephraim says, bumping his hip against mine. He's been playing host for the last hour wandering around the mill greeting everyone who arrives.
It's an old Scottish ballad that the pipers and fiddlers would play while soldiers chugged whiskey in preparation for battle.
Let's hope a battle doesn't break out tonight, I say, as my eyes drift to where Cyrus is spinning Dolly around the dance floor. I have not forgotten what happened at the last frolic.
Ephraim shrugs. You know how these things go. It isn't uncommon for fists to fly toward the end of an evening, after that nasty cider has been passed around for hours.
That only happens when one boy thinks another has had more than his fair share of turns around the dance floor with a pretty girl. Were that to happen, I'd put my money on Barnabas. I've seen his fists in action.
So far, Dolly has only danced with her brothers. There's no reason for him to get jealous just yet.
There is a cloud of fine, powdered sawdust in the air, kicked up by the swirling, dancing feet of 60 young people as they match the beat of the song. It's a wonderful kind of chaos, and the mill smells of dust and wood smoke, joy and sweat, whiskey and apple cider. It also smells of mating. Not sex, per se, that is entirely different, though none of the parents here tonight are fool enough to think it couldn't happen. But mating, that ritual common to all species. The flirting, posturing, choosing, dancing, the occasional kiss stolen in the dark, hidden from watchful eyes. It all has an ancient smell, like dark soil and ripe fruit, like humanity at the most basic elemental level.
The world must be peopled, Benedict so helpfully observed in Much Ado About Nothing. It remains my favorite Shakespeare play for that line alone, though the rest of his monologue about Beatrice's virtues doesn't hurt. So it's no wonder there are 15 chaperones at the mill tonight, parents gathered along the edges of the room, or sitting in the loft, sipping from their own jugs of cider and ale and whiskey, keeping a weather eye on their children below. When Barnabas grows tired after the fifth song, the dancers take a break. They fill their cups and wander over to the table for a bit of food. John Cowan, the young blacksmith's apprentice, weaves through the crowd and holds out his hand for the fiddle. He arrived with Catherine Pollard this evening and has been dancing with her since the first song. I look to where Abigail watches him with interest. More refined in her drinking tastes than most, she nurses a mug of mulled wine. It isn't only John Cowan she's keeping an eye on tonight, but Moses as well. He didn't arrive with Hannah, given that we're hosting the dance, but he has stayed close to her side all evening. It isn't easy, is it? I ask, after making my way to the loft where Abigail leans against the rail.
What?
Keeping your eyes on two at once.
That is why the good Lord gave me two eyes in the first place, she says with a grin.
It's you I pity.
How so? You've got 4 children of age down there and only half the eyes needed to keep track of them.
Ephraim is here.
She laughs. But as usual, he only has eyes for you.
Abigail isn't wrong. I can feel the heat of my husband's gaze as he moves through the mill. And when I look to him, he greets me with a ready smile. On the other side of the room, Barnabas whispers something to John Cowan. He no more looks like a musician than I a pirate, yet he climbs onto the stump, sets bow to strings with an exquisite gentleness, and begins to play. The tune that rises is every bit as lovely as the one Barnabas finished a few moments ago, though slower. I recognize Whiskey for Breakfast after the first few notes. My father once told me that the song was an ode to those who stayed up so late that they quite literally had their whiskey before their breakfast. And based on the determined look in Barnabas's eyes, I see that he requested it on purpose. He flexes his fingers as he moves around the edge of the room toward Dolly. Her eyes light up at the sight of him. And there it is, the ask. Barnabas bows and holds out his hand in question.
Dolly curtsies and receives it. And then they melt into the crowd of dancers, her arm around his neck and his hand at her waist. Clever boy, I think. After watching them dance for a moment, I leave Abigail and return to the main floor and go to stand beside the wide double doors, hoping for a draft to cool me down. When Ephraim sneaks up behind me and kisses me below my ear, I startle, then lean against him when he laughs. How long has it been? I ask.
Since what?
Since we last hosted one of these.
He presses his chin against my temple. Must have been when Lucy was being courted by that town boy.
That town boy, I think. Aaron Town is his name. But my husband has never forgiven that town boy for getting his daughter pregnant out of wedlock. He'd married her well in time for the birth, of course. They were in love, after all. But Ephraim remains inflexibly old-fashioned about such matters.
Do not take what doesn't belong to you, he has lectured our sons on endless occasions. I don't have the heart to tell him that, in one case at least, I suspect the lectures have been in vain.
Would have been sooner if your sons could be bothered to court someone.
They're mine now, are they?
Only seems fair we trade off taking the blame.
It's hard to find anyone in the swirling crowd, but eventually I see Jonathan's bobbing head, and then the flash of Sally Pierce's auburn hair. She has worn it down tonight, and it gleams in the lamplight. As usual, she looks at him with those ridiculous mooning eyes. Sally's convinced him to give her one dance at least. Her cheeks are round and her smile bright. Sally is a lovely girl, tall but not towering, buxom, and I notice that her gown has been cut to enhance these assets instead of her waistline.
It's not the first dance, Ephraim tells me. That's the third. You haven't been paying attention.
It's not Sally I've been looking for.
Who then?
Sarah White. Ephraim puts his hands on my hips and turns me around to face him.
I thought you weren't going to meddle.
I'm providing options, that's all. He smiles at me, broad and teasing to show he's not displeased.
I never said it was a bad idea.
It would solve two problems at once. She'd be safe and provided for, and Cyrus could finally settle down with a family of his own.
Does love not factor in?
Ephraim asks. I suspect he's there already. And yes, she might take a bit longer, but love can grow between two people. I've seen it happen more than once. Besides, we were lucky. I add, for us it exploded.
As it did for Lucy, he tells me, and I can see how the admission pains him. As it is for Hannah now, and for Dolly too. They're nearly blinded by love out there on the dance floor. It's coming off them in waves like steam from a pan. You'd want something less for Sarah?
It's a better future than raising a child on her own. I only want her to be open to the idea.
And forcing it on her will do that?
I would never force anything. I just...
What?
I want to see what would happen between them if the idea was given a chance to grow.
It will never work if it's your idea. It would have to be hers.
I nod, understanding. Because it's a woman who does the choosing.
And you need to consider that perhaps she has already chosen.
A man who got her pregnant and left her with a child? Clearly she chose wrong.
Wrong or right, doesn't matter. Sarah isn't here tonight. She's made that choice at the very least.
Ephraim kisses me on the nose, then pats me on the bottom and goes off to join the other fathers in the loft.
Well, I think, maybe she just needs another opportunity.
The song ends and the dancers catch their breath. But then John Cowan begins his third song, St. Anne's Reel, and a wave of laughter rises above the music. Cyrus and young Ephraim are shadow dancing in the middle of the circle, each with an invisible partner. By the end of the first verse, they're both clapping and stomping their feet. And by the end of the second, they've acquired real partners from the crowd. I head over to the food table to see what I can do about my growling stomach. Abigail Pollard has brought an entire side of roasted beef for the occasion, and the other families have contributed as well, each bringing their specialties. There is chicken cooked in beer, venison loins stuffed with apples, and pork ribs to round out the meats. Any number of roasted vegetables, including carrots, potatoes, turnips, and chard. A wheel of cheese, now deformed, with chunks pulled out of it by greedy fingers. Breads, jams, biscuits, cakes, pies. Of both the fruit and meat variety. Roasted nuts and dried fruit. And of course, dozens of jugs of cider, ale, mead, and whiskey. I'm debating among the assortment of sweets when Sam Dalwin joins me at the table. What's a married man such as yourself doing here tonight? I ask. He shrugs, studying a plate of apple tarts, deciding which looks best, plucks one from the pile, takes a large bite. May likes the music, he says, trying not to spit crumbs. I saw them come in earlier. May has been in the loft most of the evening with a handful of other married women, watching the dance below. She looks tired and a little green, but also happy. It doesn't seem that anyone else is aware of her pregnancy. Is she feeling better? I ask. Depends on the day. I nod at the table. Bread will help, as will the cheese. Try the dried fruit as well, but I'd stay away from anything with lots of spice or salt. Give her mild foods over the next few weeks, and I'd wager she will feel better in a month. Thank you, Mistress Ballard. I will. I choose a rhubarb tart. These were made by Abigail as well, and the crust is made with butter, so flaky it crumbles onto my chin when I take the first bite. I expect Sam to load a plate for May, but instead he takes his own tart over to where Jonathan rests against the wall, taking a break from this new dance. Both men lean against a pile of stacked boards, a single foot propped up beneath them, arms crossed, heads bent, talking. Both of their faces are clouded by some trouble that seems out of place this evening. Jonathan leans his head toward Sam's ear, mutters something. Sam spits. Jonathan balls his fist. They are clearly angry, but not with each other. Jonathan says something with an expression of finality. Then Sam nods, as though they've come to an agreement. After a moment, their attention turns back to the dance, surveying the crowd. Jonathan takes turns watching Moses and Hannah, then Barnabas and Dolly. He's not said a word to me about these new suitors, but clearly they haven't escaped his attention. The gesture is protective and tender, and I am stunned to find that tears prick my eyes. For years, I have vacillated between pride and worry when it comes to this boy of mine. I desperately want him to be a good man like his father. I am also painfully aware that you cannot make a child be anything he is not. But this, the watchful vigilance over his sisters, makes me feel as though all is not lost. I turn away just as John Cowan launches into another thumping song. Someone taps my shoulder. And there is Cyrus. His dark, curly hair is mussed. Hazel eyes shining. He smiles, broad and handsome. Then he bows and extends his hand. You think it will break your heart to have a child who suffers in this way, one who is seen as damaged. You think, perhaps, that it is your fault somehow, that if only you'd done something different, taken better care of him, this would have never happened. And then he asks you to dance on a cold January evening, and you realize that perhaps you are a fool. And whatever his life may be now, different than you'd imagined all those years ago, when he grew in your womb and curled into the hand you set upon your stomach, he is perfect. I return the smile, curtsy, give him my hand. Let my boy lead me onto the dance floor. I am sorry, I tell him. Cyrus lifts an eyebrow in question. That she didn't come.
He shrugs, as though to say it isn't a big deal, as though he never thought she would.
But there is a cloud of disappointment in his eyes. And just before we step into the song, I look up to find Ephraim standing at the rail of the loft. I can see it there, written on his face, plain as day. Heartbreak. He wants for Cyrus exactly what he found for himself. Then the song swells, the beat rises through the floorboards, and I am swept away.